Welcome, everyone, to another special episode of The Ready Room. We hate to do this twice in 2 weeks, but we've lost another member of the Star Trek family. Someone very important to helping the franchise become what we know it as today. So joining me once again is my friend Larry Nemechek. Larry, it feels like we just did this. Now, why are we here again?
Chris, we've got to stop meeting like this.
I know. We should find some better reasons to get together.
Yeah, let's do that. I feel like I'm at family where I don't see my extended family until it's a funeral anymore.
Right.
No, the passing of Harb Bennett, which was we heard about on actually, I heard about it before practically most of the world did, because Terry Rio, who's the biographer of DeForest Kelley, has been a good friend of Harv's and helped me stay in touch with him over the last 10 years or so, because we had Harb Bennett recorded for The Con of Wrath, my documentary. And his wife told me at the time that that would be his last on-film interview, and that was 2011. So I'm very glad we got to him, but his mind was sharp as a tack, but his heart, I knew, was giving him problems then. And I knew he'd been in and out of skilled care. But we were keeping in touch. Terry let me know on, was it Thursday? Yes, Thursday, what was going on, that he had died the week before. And she had let me know, and Nick Meyer, who views Harv as his mentor, and William Shatner's website manager. And she's like, okay, boys, take it away. Here's the basic detail. And that's how it hit. And then I was trying to tweet that out, but the package that Nick's agent got to the website deadline basically broke the story. And then I was trying to clean up a little bit online and get to people on Twitter at the same time, social media wise. So yeah, so it was kind of a close front row seat to this, unfortunately. And then of course within a few hours it had exploded, and people to a world that was already weary of,
right.
You know, just been through with Leonard, and the same day that the story broke about Harrison Ford and his airplane crash.
I was going to say, it's like everything, and you know the thing about celebrities dying in threes. And so when Harrison Ford's plane came down, we had people in the Babel Conference, our listeners group, saying, if I lose Leonard Nimoy, Harb Bennett, and Harrison Ford all in 1 week, I don't know how I'll deal with that.
Right. Well, a lot of people had pointed to it was much quieter, and he not quite on the same level of Leonard, not to be ranking people, but not on the same level of Leonard and Harv. But Maurice Hurley had died the week before, who had been their first emergent showrunner on The Next Generation the first year and a half, left at the end of the second season and helped hire Michael Wagner, who left after 3 weeks, and then Michael Piller rushed in and turned the third season around and almost killed him. But, you know, and the rest, as they say, is history with Next Generation and all the spinoffs there. But Maury Hurley will always be down as somebody who stabilized the writing staff and created the Borg, you know. So,
that's right.
So some people were pointing, you know, Rick Berman had tried to point that out the week before in his tweets, if people were missing it. But, and then Leonard kind of took over the airways and the bandwidth.
Right. Well, let's talk about Harv Bennett a bit here, because unlike with Leonard Nimoy, where every Star Trek fan knows exactly who Leonard Nimoy
and
was,
and well beyond
Spock,
Star Trek's family.
I mean, globally, I don't think very few people don't know who the character Spock is, even if they're not Star Trek fans, and Leonard Nimoy. Now, Harv Bennett, on the other hand, is a name that a lot of Star Trek fans may either not know, or simply they've heard the name, but they don't really know much about him. Those of us who grew up with the original series, of course, know Harv Bennett and the role that he played. But those who grew up with Voyager, which is a large percentage of the fan base these days, and even those who grew up with TNG may not realize his contributions to Star Trek, but he is the man, one of the key figures behind The Wrath of Khan, The Search for Spock, and The Voyage Home. The trilogy, even if it wasn't planned as such, that really reinvigorated the franchise, and especially The Wrath of Khan, is the reason why we have The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Voyager and Enterprise and everything else.
Right. Right. Yes. The Next Generation era, which, you know, was in numbers, was, people have a hard time believing this, but the Next Generation audience, when it took off in third season, fourth season, fifth season, was growing by leaps and bounds. The numbers were way bigger than even the rerun generation popularity of the original series that finally got the movie series going and then finally led to the comeback of, in TV form, in episodic form of the Next Generation. But no, for the fans in the 70s and the 80s, Harve Bennett was a guy who was not a yeoman at all. He, in fact, there's some great stories from younger in his life, but he had had some several, you know, he had several successful TV shows. I mean, kiddies, if I rattled off, oh, I don't know, The Mod Squad, The $6 Million Man, The Bionic Woman, one of those wonderful one-hit wonders, Salvage One. And he was in the middle of producing what was really, you know, when the miniseries was a big trend in TV, you know, before we had cable networks, and we just still had the four main networks, you know, even before Fox came in. And the miniseries were big. Rich Man, Poor Man was this big, oh, what a concept this is, the miniseries. And he had Rich Man, Poor Man. He did a TV movie, The Jesse Owens Story. He did A Woman Called Golda, which he finally won an Emmy Award for, and after being nominated. And that was Ingrid Bergman's last acting job, and it co-starred Leonard Nimoy as playing her husband. She played Golda Meir.
Yeah, in our last show that we did when we were remembering Leonard Nimoy. Yeah.
These are overlapping. Chris. We have to stop this. But no, so he had this incredible resume. But even at the time when he had done a lot of TV, very popular genre TV, Paramount, which was owned by Gulf and Western back then, you know, Charlie Bluthorn, when the motion picture came out, made a ton of money. It technically made the most money of any movie until the JJ movies were, you know, like mega budget, mega hit around the world. And although unfairly had all the budget, all the expenses of the off again, on again, first series, small movie, then phase two, the money for the scripts and the sets that were built and people hired, you know, all that money got dumped into the budget of the motion picture. Finally, they just, those expenses got, had to be covered by that. So it made a ton of money. They were writing things off to it. And it, you know, the original reason for Star Trek fandom was to bring it back. And that happened. But, you know, people love, they dissect, they whatever about the motion picture. But it was lackluster in many ways. And the studio knew they could do more. And Charlie Bluthorn very famously calls Harve Bennett into a meeting and says, "Did you see the motion picture?" And he talks about how he didn't know how to answer. Do I say, yes, it was great and I'm a cheerleader? Or does he be honest and say, well, it was a lot of money and it looked flashy, but my little girl fell asleep in act three and I almost did, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was honest. And he says, that's what I said. And, you know, and he has studio guys in the room who went on to be famous, but he says, that movie cost $40-45 million. Could you do a movie for $45 million, a better movie? And he says, Mr. Bluthorn, I can do four movies for $45 million. Because he came from a TV background. And, you know, Wrath of Khan started in a TV, a glorified TV movie footing. And after they got into it, you know, very, very frugally. But after he hired Nick Meyer, Harve Bennett was the one who sat down, researched the original series, because he didn't come from a Trek background. He watched all 79 shows. He decided out of all of that, this show with this Khan guy is intriguing. That's just a natural hook there where they leave him on this planet. You know, and it had naturally been 10, 15 years had gone by in real time. Everybody's older. So all the themes of the movie started emerging his kind of direction. Of course, they really kicked into gear when he brought Nick Meyer in. And they had five different writers had done treatments. Robert Salen is the credited one. Most of his was used, but they really pulled together. Nick Meyer's uncredited, jumped in, said this is a mess. Just famous for the 7% solution, the Sherlock Holmes kind of cool time travel movie. But he wrote and directed.
Which, quick pitch for that, because many people may not have read that. If you want to know all about that, go over, listen to commentary Trek Stars, because that and all of Nick Meyer's work is covered over there.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And it's great. So Nick Meyer was young. I think he was in his late 20s, if not early 30s then.
Yeah.
And Harve Bennett hired him to come in and do this, to write it. And Nick said, you know, well, I'll do that. I can solve this, but you have to let me direct if I'm going to do it. So they kind of like dared each other, and you know, it was already Harve Bennett was already out on a line on a wire to make this work, and they hired Nick Meyer, and these guys' backs were kind of up against the wall. It's a lot like yesterday's Enterprise on Next Generation that everybody thought was just going to be a cluster F, and right. It wound up being this incredible show. So these guys were out there, backs against the wall on a small budget, and turned out this cinematic high bar for all Star Trek movies right. that everybody agrees is the best ever, that people have always tried to, you know, they use that as the measuring stick for everything. So, but that was Harve Bennett. He was the guy in the right place at the right time who had a humble background, was not steeped in Star Trek. And he researched it, and I remember this because I subscribed to Interstat. Kiddies, this is before internet. This is before, you know, anything. And in the most insiderly way you could keep up with things, unless you were one of the 5 or 10 big-name fans that ran the world of fandom back then, was you subscribed to Interstat, which was a letter of comment zine, an LOC zine or a LOC zine, and people were writing letters back and forth once a month. In the snail mail.
Yeah.
It's like you could turn your computer on and get a message board once a month.
Right.
You know, 20 pages worth of messages
once
a month.
Your Twitter feed updates once a month.
Yeah.
With three tweets.
With three tweets, yeah. Well, maybe 20. But also columns and news. And he reached out to Terry Meyer, who was the editor, and reached out to fans and said, and was very cordial and gracious, and was kind of a breakthrough. And he recognized the fan, you know, such as it was, fan media then, the way it existed, and the Well Committee, and was very open to fans because he wanted to make this thing work. And he took people's opinions. You know, kudos. I mean, I tweeted this the other day. I said, if only all producers who come into an established franchise reach out, do their homework, and reach out to fans like Harve Bennett did. And I meant that across the board. I wasn't, you know, pointing any fingers or anything. I was just saying I think of that now. At the time, I didn't think in those terms, but there's so much of history and even our pop culture and our Star Trek history that you look back on and go, and you put it in, you filter it and you frame it in current terms and you go, oh, this is what this would have been then. Like Interstat was once a month, Facebook page or something for 20 messages. But yeah, he was really smart that way. And not that he had a big history. The other shows he'd done were original creations. He hadn't done that before. But all of that contributed, I think, to that. And he just had a good story. He wasn't just a producer. He had a good story sense. He, like I said, he picked out Khan.
Well, that's why The Wrath of Khan on such a small budget grabs us, whereas the motion picture with that big budget doesn't necessarily. It's the story.
Well, they were busy competing with Star Wars and, you know, way beyond Gene. It was such a big political mess and there was so much pressure to do it, and they committed to a date, and, you know, we have gone through all that before. But anyway, it's safe to say, I think, Chris, that you go backwards, you know, all the spinoffs wouldn't be here without Next Generation.
Exactly.
Next Generation would not be here without the movie series being a hit, especially through Star Trek IV. The movie series would not have relaunched and become what it was if not for the amazing bounce of The Wrath of Khan. The Wrath of Khan was to Star Trek the same thing that The Best of Both Worlds was to Next Generation.
Well, maybe even bigger, in my opinion.
Right. Well, it was cinema. It was a big screen, and it was a broader audience. And
But I mean, I think The Next Generation, The Best of Both Worlds obviously was a game changer for that show. But I can still see the show continuing and the fan base growing a bit. Whereas if The Wrath of Khan had not been the huge success that it was, I think that would have been the end. We would have had The Wrath of Khan, but we would not have had any more films or spinoff series.
Or whatever The Wrath of Khan became if it wasn't what we know it as.
Sure. But the second movie would have been
the end of the road.
End point.
And people, an ever smaller cult of viewers would have kept watching 79 episodes and two movies until they all died off.
Well, Larry, keeping in my tradition of pointing out things that maybe you didn't think about yet, because we're talking about the other work here of Harve Bennett, I noticed a pattern in his work. And tell me if you see anything here. He seems to be drawn to certain types of titles anyway. The $6 Million Man, the Gemini man, rich man, poor man, the invisible man, the bionic woman also. And let's also not forget, as you mentioned already, a woman called Golda and Alex and the Doberman gang.
What are you saying? He's sexist? What are you saying?
No, I'm saying that he seems to have a penchant for making films and TV shows that have man in the title.
Well,
that's all.
You know, okay.
And dogs, because a Doberman is actually a dog. So.
I've said this for years. Your point about we need to reiterate this for the fans who have only been around for 15 or 20 years. That's scary. 10 or 15 years. But... You know, and Nick Meyer said this in the statement when he helped get the word out to Deadline.com, and then the trade papers picked it up from there about Harv passing, and then everybody bungled the death date. He made a big pitch, and good on him for pointing out what we've just been talking about, that we need to make sure and not let Harv Bennett fall between the cracks, which I'd never done that, but makes a good point that we are turning over in fandom and new fans so much that we need to keep doing this over and over, and hopefully this show is helping out a little bit. Remembering this pivotal point in Star Trek history and what a place Harv Bennett played there. So you're going with this man in the title theme, and one of my little bumper sticker memes for Harv Bennett is I say, you know, there's maybe three or four people I would say was the man who saved Star Trek, quote unquote, on a little brass plaque. Yeah. And I would put Michael Piller in one of those, just like I would put Harv Bennett with Nick Meyer, who he hired, brought into the fold, right behind. So there's times I even want to put Gene Kuhn into that mold, because I think Gene Roddenberry in the first season was burning out so fast that he had John D.F. Black. But I think Gene Kuhn came in as the writing machine and saved Gene's butt as far as not having to grind and grind and grind.
And I think there are most TOS fans will say, you know, Gene Kuhn does not get enough credit.
Yeah, and he died early. He died in 1973. Yeah. He missed the entire comeback bandwagon. But my point was going to be putting the irony, it just occurred to me when you made that little quasi-serious joke, that, you know, Michael Piller's thing as a man who saved Star Trek, he got off on the V titles, right?
Yeah.
The Defector, The Hunted, The High Ground, the. So I guess maybe one of the qualifications of being a man who saved Star Trek, and not to be genderist, but, you know, is that you have to get into a title rut. Maybe that's the qualification.
Maybe.
Well, that was certainly extended in treatise there that didn't have a payoff. But that serves you right for raising the man issue there. He has plenty of titles that have no man or even woe man in them. So they're all the failures, apparently.
Well, it reminds me of this great series that's on Hulu right now, produced by BBC, called The Wrong Mans, which is a very short, it's a comedy series, but quite good.
That's interesting. So. I just called this up real fast. Originally, the title was going to be Salvage Man 1. I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding.
Salvage Man, it sounds like...
Salvage Man, Salvage Man does whatever Salvage Man can.
That's right.
I don't know.
I was just hearing the theme song in my head right there.
Well, and here's another cute thing. He did a movie about this experience. So he was born in Chicago, Harv was. When he was a kid on radio, there was a radio show, like a novelty game show called Quiz Kids.
Okay.
And like young kids were given questions... You know, that was the format. I don't know if they were playing for money or they had charities they played for, whatever. But when he was a young man, he was one of the quiz. He was very bright. He was one of the quiz kids, which is a wacky thing. He had that little claim to fame of nothing. It's like being one of the little rascals in Spanky's in our gang or something. You know, it's kind of like only for a brainy thing.
Yeah, I didn't know that one. Boy, I thought you were about to channel Johnny Carson there, though. That's wild, wacky stuff.
No. That's and then he for people that are want to know this too. Of course, everyone was drafted in those days, but he was at World War II age. He died. He was 84 here when he died. He was born in 1931, so he was a tad young for World War II. But in the Korea era and just after, he was a draftee, and he was in the military. He was a MP, you know, for his 2 or 3 years in the army in the mid-50s. So he's a veteran. But, you know, that generation, they pretty much all were during the draft years. But anyway, just a lot of you know, pieces of his life leading up to this fact when he did his part to save Star Trek.
So you mentioned confusion about the death date, and I know we've talked about this on the other side of the room, but there was confusion about the birth date, and I guess it's actually, as we're recording this, still trying to get it sorted out in different places to make sure that the death date is correct. So what caused the confusion within the media, anyway, about the death date?
Well, when, you know, Harv had been retired, he did a couple of projects after. We haven't talked about his history with the Trek movies yet. I guess we can do that in a minute. But just right here in the here and now, he was retired. He still kept his irons in the fire. I don't think any actor, producer, any creative likes to think they ever retire, right?
Sure.
And he had some, you know, projects out. And in fact, he was kind of miffed. You know, Harv Bennett had a script for Star Trek VI that was an Academy Years script with young actors. Yeah. Playing cadet level Kirk and Spock and all the crew, how it fit. And Paramount started to go with it. He certainly had a track. He'd just done the first four movies and even made five not be so bad. But he was really thinking it was time to come and do this. And they first said yes, and then change of administration at Paramount. And then they thought, no, it's the 25th anniversary. Let's have the original crew one more time. And they offered him to do the movie, and if he would go with that, and he said, nope, I want to do my script, and I think I've earned the right to do this. And he basically, it was kind of like Gene with the third season time slot. He made his stand, they didn't take him up on it, and he walked. And he did some projects after that. That was really kind of the high point of his Hollywood years, even though, like I said, he kept his hand in. And he retired, wound up retiring to Seattle first, and then wound up in Oregon because, as with so many people in the entertainment industry, Gene included, many of our favorite actors in the cast and other kind of creatives across the board, he had several marriages. And I'm not sure if it's fourth or fifth, because IMDb and Wikipedia sure doesn't know, but it was either his fourth or fifth wife was the wife that he spent his last years with, very happily appeared, when we visited him in 2011, up just outside of Medford, Oregon, in one of the little suburbs around that small city north of Ashland, just over the California line. Very pretty part of southern Oregon. And he was elderly, but still had a sharp mind. But his wife had told us when we left, she said, this is going to be his last on-camera interview. He'd done DVD bonus features for $6 Million Man and Bionic Woman, at the very least, plus some of his other series. And we were, wow, okay. Well, I'm glad we made it, and it was great, you know, to sit down and do that. He and I had met a couple of times off and on, but we had this, like, 10-year running joke about, we're going to sit down and have that huge interview, right? So when the idea for Con of Wrath came along about the 1982 infamous Star Trek biggest event planned ever turned into biggest Star Trek meltdown ever that we're working on, Harv was one of the two. He and Walter Koenig were the two I knew I had to have before I even thought about going further. And Harv was yes, hell yes. You know, so his enthusiasm was wonderful. We did a road trip up to him, and we got him. And I said, can we talk about things beyond the Houston Con of Wrath weekend? He said, yes. So in general terms, we talked about all the movies, some off-the-wall things about being there that I'd wanted to talk to him about that I'd always was curious about, like what it was like to be doing movies while the TV series were going and they were totally different, you know, production mm-hmm. companies, what that was like. And some other stories. And then we talked about his projects beyond Trek as much as we could. And I would say every hour or so, I'd say, are you still good to go on? Oh, yeah, let's keep talking. And we were there about 5 hours. We probably talked on camera for about 3 hours of the 4 to 5 hours. And he was very tired at the end. I did not want to be abusive at all. Did not want that on my conscience. But I kept asking, and he was a big boy. And so we have a lot of really cool kind of off the wall Trek bits and pieces are in this footage that I have. And then his wife told me that as we were leaving, and I was like, wow. And part of me knew that maybe he talked to cameras before. I know one specific thing I asked him, is there something you haven't talked about on camera yet that you'd like to? And he said, well, I haven't really talked about A Woman Called Golda much. I'm like, oh my God, yes, let's do that. So we did. But, I just had the feeling that he had a feeling that he'd better go as far as he could talking about whatever he could, because it might be his last time. You know, mm-hmm. not to be morbid or bittersweet about it, but you get to a place like that. It's kind of like Leonard trying to do those Skypes with cons and fans as long as he could, you know, and still tell some new stories as long as he could. But so he's up in fair, not rural Oregon, but not in any big urban area. His wife apparently is with a caretaker now, and he had been in and out of assisted living. I had tried to keep up with him. Our mutual friend, Terry Rio, who wrote DeForest Kelly's biography and is in touch with Nick Meyer, who also has talked about how Harv, when Harv hired him, even though he had done the 7% solution, he views Harv as more or less his mentor from his Hollywood, you know, his Hollywood upbringing, so to speak.
Right.
And so they were all, you know, kind of close and in that circle. And Terry had been trying to reach Harv for the last few months and finally had a Jacksonville policeman, the local town there, go out to do what we call, I'm an old reporter, what they call a welfare check when they can't reach somebody. Mm-hmm. Is not answering their phone or whatever, and found out that his wife was with a caretaker, apparently. And I hope none of this is too out of turn yet, but basically his wife was not available to help him. He fell, complications from that, and was in the hospital there for a while and died in the hospital there in Medford nearby. But it was on the 25th, but because he was gone, Harv had no children. The one wife that he'd been with for at least, you know, 5 to 10 years there in Oregon, she was not in a position to be doing anything. Her caregiver was not in a position to know, oh, here's a Hollywood celebrity we should get word out about. And it was just one of those cases where it was, you know, kind of a black hole. And if it hadn't been for Terry having the police go check up and see what's going on, you know, we still might not know. So basically, Terry let Nick Meyer, myself, and William Shatner's webmaster, you know, put it up to us to get it out to the world. And I was coordinating with Nick. He had his agent get it to Deadline to get it to the trade papers, which was kind of the mainstream way. I was trying to put it out, but I didn't want to get ahead of that. I don't, right. You know, I have no ego to bruise, Captain. I didn't care about being the guy who broke this story. I mean, it needed to be done, but I wasn't in any big hurry to do that. But so basically and then I was on the phone with another project, and in the time that Deadline got the story up and it broke, and I didn't have to worry about it. But everyone read Nick's note as last Wednesday to mean the day before Thursday, when they meant last Wednesday, the week before. But what was complicating it is Oregon apparently has a weird public records law where only family is entitled to records like death certificates. And so even if you're a reporter, so I was trying to call. There wasn't a funeral. There wasn't an obit in the paper from a funeral home or anything in any of the local papers there. The little local paper or the Medford, you know, area papers had no clue. I got a reporter there working on it. He couldn't get any information. So finally today, but we knew because the policeman that called Terry back had said the day, which is what Nick really sent on, and people misquoted it. Bill Shatner's website, thanks to Big Paul, they had it right. I had it right in my tweets and my posting. But today, finally, they'd gotten the EMT service, whatever, the fire ambulance police combined command for Southern Oregon, basically came through and confirmed to the local reporter there that it was indeed February 25th. And I've noticed today, this will all be old hat by the time this is posted, but So our impression of, you know, Leonard died and then, oh my God, now here's Harv's death. It was really a, you know, word has been received of the death of that Harv actually passed away 2 days before Leonard. Right. Not that that makes any difference, actually, but in the cosmic.
They passed away even closer together than we thought.
Right, yeah. Right. And they're basically born within the same year or so. I mean, you know, the same time frame. So anyway, it's just been an incredible week, and the death dates being, you know, cleared up, and but it just shows it's very sobering that I don't want to say it's one of those oh how the mighty have fallen, because it wasn't a case of that, but it's just, you know, everybody has their moment of fame, the moment of glory, their moment of achievement, and for whatever reason we all you know wind up being dust to dust again at some point. So it's but I'm glad we're here. I'm glad the world is here. I'm glad Nick Meyer said what he did. I'm doing my part. I'm sure other people will do their part to make sure that Harv's place in Trek fandom, as well as, you know, he won Emmys. He won other awards. He did some really incredible work. And he has his connection to history here. So, you know, he did the Trek movies that boomed the franchise enough to make a TV comeback happen.
Absolutely. Well, you were just talking about the 3 hours you spent on camera or talking to him on camera. And I don't know what the long-term plans are for that footage, but without giving anything away that you might want to say for later, I mean, what was one of the most interesting things, whether it's Star Trek or not, but about his life, his career, that you found out when you were talking to him?
Well, you know, we spent probably half the time talking about the Wrath of Khan, or the Khan of Wrath. And I knew, you know, I compressed my scope of questions. It wasn't like we were sitting down, I'll come back in a couple of months and we'll talk about each movie individually or all your project. Yeah. You know, I knew that wasn't going to be the case, and I didn't know how much time I'd have. So I didn't even, I had two or three things I'd always wanted to ask him. Well, here's one thing funny, and it turned out to be a bust. But I remember back in the Interstat days when I was little, I was the minority of, you know, I'm always on my soapbox about women in fandom. Well, the readership of Interstat was 3/4 women by the letters they wrote. And they were always talking about characters. And not that I'm a tech head. I enjoy talking about the characters as much as anybody, but they would get into like character wars. And way before this term shipping, you know, I'm a shipper, blah, blah, that's what they were doing. There just wasn't that term for it. And I would try to, me and maybe two or three other minority men in there, it seemed to be a sexist gender-based thing. I know not totally. And I would say, okay, well, you know, I'm not a tech head, but let's talk about some background questions I have. And da, da, da. And so when Harv opened himself up and we knew that he was reading Interstat, it's a little bit like how people know that Bob Orsi was reading TrekMovie.com, you know, kind of a thing. Yeah. When we knew that Harv was reading and actually would occasionally respond or would put a little notice letter in at the end where he wouldn't answer people directly, but he would say, and I remember asking at the time, I was saying, going on and on about after 2 and after 3, I know this shocks you to death, Chris, but I was actually back at the time going, okay, when are we going to see some signs of the Greater Federation? When are we going to have Tellarites and Andorians and the other races? When are we going to get off this ship?
Larry,
what?
You got to be making this up. Now, you were concerned about when are we going to see Tellarites. I cannot believe that that's true.
If I'm lying, I'm dying, Chris. No, not just Tellarites. I'm saying, when are we going to journey to Babelize this? You know, when are we going to get open up the scope of the whole Star Trek universe and get beyond our five little characters and all that? So then what was the very next movie? Oh, look, it's, you know, the Voyage Home with the scenes of the Federation Council meeting and all the, you know, some of them done to various degrees of quality and some of them a little bizarre. It's kind of like when you have a movie and a crew that assembles every, it's not like you have a TV continuity where they're working every week for, you know, half the year. It's you have people show up and maybe they didn't work on the last movie. They know nothing about old Star Trek, but, you know, you don't have a Mike Westmore or a Mike Okuda or Dan Curry or a Bob Blackman providing that show to show continuity. You do in some levels, but not in others. But I'd wondered for years if part of those scenes were out of that kid from Oklahoma griping about how they're not griping, but going, please, please show us the Federation. Give us some windows into the Greater Federation and the diversity of the, you know. So part of the thing was one of the things I asked Harv, I said, now I'm going to take you back here. Do you remember the Oh, yes, of course, Terry Meyer. Do you remember going into 4, remembering somebody insistently once or twice writing letters about, please, please, please include a scene of the Greater Federation in 4, you know, and then maybe that leading to the Federation Council scene. And he kind of looked off and thought for a minute or two and then came back and said, no, not really. So I, of course, in my infinite, you know, wisdom, just chalked that up to him being old and forgetful and just said, no, I had to have
it.
So, no, that was a fun little moment.
That's what really happened, but we forget things as we get older.
That's what happened. Yeah. No, but I had some great talk. He knew Jeffrey Hunter from UCLA and told me about knowing Jeffrey Hunter as a young actor. Wow. He a story that is in Bob Justman and Herb Solo's book about the time that very young junior ABC executive Harv Bennett was sent out to fire Gene Roddenberry on a pilot shoot when they were shooting a pilot called The Long Hunt of April Savage. Yeah. And Gene and Herb Solo were producing it and producing it. And Robert Lansing, Gary Seven, and 12 O'Clock High and other roles, if you remember this, was the lead. And Gene loved Robert Lansing and the guys overseeing it at ABC as a pilot. They hated him And they saw the first three or four dailies back in New York, and they hated him. And they kept trying to tell Gene to fire him and start over before any more money went down the drain. Like, stop the production, go hire somebody else, come back and shoot it. Because they were on location, too. This was mainly shot out in the wilds. And Gene refused. He wouldn't take their calls. He ignored. And finally, ABC Honchos turned to a young junior exec who got stuck with this job of flying out to wherever they were in location in California, wherever it was in the West, and walking to the set and saying, either fire him now or I'm shutting down this shoot. And guess who the junior executive was that they turned to do that? So flash forward about 10 years to who gets the reins of the franchise, and Gene is kind of kindly demoted, you know, as an executive, as a producer over everything through, you know, the political monster that was the motion picture, for good and bad. And so, you know, there's another extra level of tech. When I read Herb and Bob's book, I was like, oh my God, there's a whole other level of texture and friction and, you know, whatever. But to both men's credit, they navigated it and went on to, you know, work together in Gene's role as a consultant and note giver, who's many times they went out of their way to make sure if he had a strenuous objection to something, they would honor it. Or if he really had some significant notes, they would honor that and try to, you know, he really didn't want Savick to be back in Star Trek VI. And so that's why they created the all new character of Valeris. They did not make it Savick again. So, you know, Gene, you know, when he put his foot down on things, they would listen to that. But it was still an uncomfortable situation to navigate. And I got to ask Harv about, I got to have him tell that story on camera from his perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of little things like that. And then we talked about his other projects. And we even talked about Galaxy Quest. And, you know, the Rockman. By then he was getting kind of tired, but... he said, and the little Rockman kind of homage to what we talked about Star Trek V. And he talked at length about what it was. And he told me that he initially, that Bill had the concept of the Enterprise crew finds God. And I'll save it to him to talk about it. I'll save that for people to see somewhere down the road. But basically, he tried to talk him out of it and say, you can't do that in a movie. You can't do that in any kind of a movie. Whose God is it? You know, what interpretation? And he, when Shatner wouldn't change his mind, he was adamant, you know, creative, passionately adamant, like Bill Shatner can be. Harv basically said, okay, you're going to have to do this. I don't, as nice as he could, he walked away from it. And Bill persuaded him to come back, and he went ahead and stayed with it, which is something that's been kind of lost. But it was interesting to hear him talk about that. And he said, here's how I find in my own conscience and my own creative, you know, conscience, here's how I tried to do it. But ultimately, we could not overcome that basic flaw in the premise. And that's what it was. Because I had said, well, was it that they cut his budget? They couldn't let him have all the visual effects he wanted. And he's like, no. It was flawed from the beginning.
I think a lot of fans would agree with that. I don't 100% agree with that myself. But I think that is the sticking point for a lot of fans. And I think he had a pretty good point there.
Well, and then we were talking about Galaxy Quest, and I said, and there's even the Rockman homage to Star Trek V right. in there. And he gave me the best look ever. He just gave me kind of this, like, I know, right? kind of look. It was just priceless. So, I mean, I had met him once or twice. Because, you know, my arrival in L.A. as working in the franchise and you know, was Next Generation based and forward, and it was really in the communicator era where I had the professional oomph, surely not the, you know, not the fanboy interest, but the you know, if I'm going to spend a lot of time on this, I need to be getting paid for it, kind of reality check. And it wasn't until communicator and fact files that I really, you know, professionally started diving back into original series and the movies. And in that era was when we would touch base on things and I would see him at events. And he was very warm and kind even then. Of course, he wasn't actively doing anything. He was, you know, still pitching projects. And he had a few projects. You look at his IMDb and was doing Time Tracks. That's a series that a lot of people remember with some fondness. And we had this ongoing thing of, you know, like, okay, I'm going to sit down with you and we're going to catch up. We're going to have a long, big interview. And he said, okay, we'll do that. And before we even did that, he wrote a very sweet, when the communicator had its 150th issue in 2004, and we had congratulation letters from people. He wrote this long, glowing. He had worked with Dan Madsen in the movie era when Dan was doing the magazine by himself, basically with writers.
Yeah.
But he wrote a very wonderful piece to the magazine and Dan, and told about working with Terry at Interstat. And, you know, I know part of that was him saying, hey, world, I'm still here. But it was great to have it out there, because even in 2004, people were starting to not appreciate where, you know, what he had done. And I was glad to see it.
Definitely. Yeah.
And he even did a shout out to me, even though we'd never met, and praised me for, you know, doing what I was doing. And I thought, well, that's, he didn't have to do that. That's very sweet of him. We're going to run your letter, Harv. You don't have to, you don't have to blow smoke, you know, kind of thing. But it was a very, it was just a very sweet letter. And even though we hadn't talked yet. And so the years went by. Oh, that was on page 47, by the way, Chris. I noticed.
Well, what other page could it be on, Larry?
I put it on my Trekland Facebook page if somebody wants to go see it. But yeah, so finally we had this moment when I called him and I said, okay, we're finally going to have that interview and it's going to be at the Conor Rath. You up for it? And he's like, hell yes. But yeah, but he was very funny, because I think he was also very conscious of not being a Hollywood. It was so silly, because when we saw him, well, here's the thing: from LA and then on the road and then in town, I'd call him and he'd say, at least twice, he said, okay, but now don't expect any big Hollywood palatial mansion. We have a very simple little hut that we live in here. And I'm like, okay, like, I don't care. Like, you know, you don't, I didn't say anything, but it's like, you don't have to apologize for. And so when we get there, and I'm thinking, well, he's out in some shack somewhere or something. I hope he has electricity to run our cameras and lights, you know. And we get there and he has this very nice little prim two-story A-frame kind of chalet looking thing with a steps up to a front porch that goes in on the second level. And then there's a downstairs and ups. Very nice. Sweet, I say little house. It was fine for two people. It was more than enough room. And the whole time I'm thinking, you're apologizing for this? And then if you see the picture that I put up on Twitter, we're toasting beer bottles. And so we got into town and I was checking in, because we drove overnight and we were going over to his house at 1. And when I confirmed about, you know, 11 that we were on track, or about noon, we were on track to show up at 1, he said, instead of apologizing for his house, he said, okay, but you know, there's not much in this old fridge over here, so if you want beer, you're going to have to bring it. And I'm like, what? And Neil, we're standing there looking at each other. Jennifer Larson, our crew friend, person that came along to help a crew, I'm kind of mouthing this like, beer. And they're like, what? And I said, okay. I said, well, I'm thinking on my feet, like, is he trying to be cute or literal or what? And I'm like, okay, I guess you got me there. Any particular brand? And he said, oh, something local. At the time, I didn't realize that it was a national brand or a regional brand, but I looked around at all of them and we found out, and because Jennifer was from around Oregon originally.
Yeah.
And she said, we found out where a beer place was. We were actually staying with Paula Block and Terry Erdman, who your readers will know the names of, who've moved up there after they got out of L.A., and just totally by coincidence, were in the neighborhood of Harv and got to see him a few times when he was still being active. And we stayed with them. Thank you very much, Paul and Terry. First time I got to see them in ages. But they said, well, yeah, there's a liquor store on the way to where you're going, and we stopped by. And I said, what's a local brand? And Jennifer said, Fat Tire is made around here.
Okay.
Oh, that's a cute local name, Fat Tire, which is now sold nationally, or almost nationally.
Well, anyway, a lot of them are sold everywhere these days.
Right. Yeah. But we get there, pull out of the car, come up to the front door. I'm carrying the beer bottles, because that was just so hysterical. There's no beer in this house, so if you want beer, you're going to have to bring it yourself. I'm like, well, that came out of nowhere. So I walked up to the front door, and he opens up, and the screen door is there so you can see out. And I'm carrying the six-pack with me. And I walked up to the door, and I looked at him, and I said, beware of Romulans bearing gifts. And he laughed, and we had one beer out of the thing where we had a little tech. We had to run back and get a cable, and we had some time to kill, so we talked. And I said, "Well, let's do pictures while we're waiting." And so we broke open the beers and took those pictures right that moment. So
that's cool.
So yeah, so you know, it's not like I knew him for 20 years. Not like we had dinner, but you knew his work. He just was a really kind guy. And, you know, it's like everybody with a creative path sometimes, a creative bent. He had several marriages, wound up with somebody that apparently he stayed with for several years till the end in his last home area up there. But, an interesting person, interesting man. I can say this now, we've tentatively set a memorial, kind of one of those public memorials is going to be at Paramount on Sunday the 15th.
Okay.
And they're just, as of today, getting the word out to people. So that'll happen. We have no word. I've not heard anything about Leonard's yet. I'm sure there'll be something equivalent to that, or maybe even than one. Maybe one in New York and or Boston, and maybe one in L.A. or whatever. But Harv's memorial will be there for the public, or a lot of invited people or whatever, and maybe some public after that. And I guess I'm helping out with that too. But and I've been in touch with him a little bit since then, but not the last year or two. I don't want to say lost track, but it'd been harder to stay in touch. And So anyway, I'm just, when she told me this will be his last, time on camera, I was just kind of floored, because it suddenly kind of fast forward you into the future.
Well, then you kind of know, like something's going on. Yeah, I wish I could be there to attend things like the memorial, but alas, I'm on the other side of the world, so.
Got one word for you. What's the character's name in, transporters. Transporters. Forget plastics.
So, well, we've talked also about the Wrath of Khan a good bit earlier, but we didn't talk too much about the search for Spock or the voyage home. So for listeners also, because it really is important what he did with those films, going into the search for Spock, coming out of the Wrath of Khan, going into Star Trek III, what were, his key contributions in your eyes anyway, that made that film successful and led us on to IV?
Well, I'm a little rusty on this, but I mean, he basically wrote, let's not forget The Wrath of Khan, Leonard was in it only if Spock was going to be killed off. It's, right. I mean, late, 20 years later, whatever it was, Brent Spiner saying, I'll do one more Trek movie if we kill off Data because I'm getting too old to play it. It's or whatever reason, but that's the same motivation going on with Leonard, because this was still in his, I really want to do other things besides, I love Spock, I love the fans, but I've really got to do, for my own sanity, I've really got to do something else with an impact. And we've talked about this, and now we've talked with Bonnie Moss about his photography and some of his other creative pursuits and other roles. Later, very soon he hit it out of the park with so many other projects that he was even more comfortable in his skin as Spock, and with Star Trek and with fans and with Shatner and all his co-stars. Not that he wasn't ever really friends, but just in a more comfortable place with that, and as far as his creative comfort zone was. But that wasn't happening in 80 and 82. And, he went into Wrath of Khan intending for Spock to be killed off. And then when, on this TV level movie, let's not forget that was part of the pie. So, When the production scope looked incredibly way beyond the budget of the movie, and it was really making a powerful impact, and Ricardo Montalban was having an incredible screen presence, and Bill Shatner's performance was really rising to it, even though the two of them never really shared the screen, and he was having second thoughts, and the whole thing of the fix at the end, right? And it's like, we'll hatch this plan as we know now. If I can direct the next movie, Leonard is saying, I'll come back and I'll go on, basically. So they reshoot the ending where the coffin is sitting. Oh, the hopeful ending, and the test audiences had been all depressed at the end, and they didn't want that. So, that was the tweak at the end of the movie. They took the forget scene with McCoy and Spock and sprung a whole movie out of that going forward. And Nick Meyer wrote a book called View from the Bridge that's been out a while, and I talked to him in footage that I've not put up yet on my site 3 or 4 years ago when it came out, and talking about it. He was really involved in every movie. He was asked to be involved in every movie, and if he wasn't involved with it, it was like his choice not to be. He either had something else going on. He was overtly involved in 2, 4, and 6.
Yeah.
And 3 and 5.
Okay, so you're talking about Nick Meyer there.
Yeah, Nick Meyer, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And 3, he's not overtly involved, but Harv did the story treatment for that. And it's online too, where it's, and I don't know if you've, I know some of the shows have discussed it, but it was a much darker script really. And the whole thing about, you know, it used Romulans instead of Klingons, which is a little bit of a, really guys, you know, they had Romulans on a bird of prey and then later on they made them Klingons. Leonard thought that Klingons were infinitely more, there you go, there's the start of the Romulans are boring meme. Leonard thought that Romulans weren't as interesting as Klingons. So they changed them to Klingons, but neglected to change the name of the ship. So ding dong, there's the birth of the Klingon bird of prey. But Harv, you know, wrote the story and then altered it and then had the you know, the co-writers with him. So he pretty much set the stage for the second leg there, the sequel to Wrath of Khan, and then worked with Nick Meyer on the script on Voyage Home, and then, you know, Leonard directed it. And then so you had like that successful, like you said, started, wound up as a trilogy, even though it didn't quite start off that way. That's how it wound up. And then oversaw 5 and birthed the baby, even though that was the hard delivery after the 3 star children, after the golden kids, then the problem child a little bit there at the end. And then finally, you know, stood his ground at the end and left. But each of those films in turn were amazing. And 4. It doesn't show up in the box office numbers, but 4 had the best global box office and really made people stand up. And it was just all a magic year. I keep saying that 1986 after 1966 is the most pivotal year. If we don't count the fact that Wrath of Khan in 82 saved the franchise, 86 was the year that everything just exploded because the whales just appealed worldwide, you know, and the studio for the first time commercially recognized a Star Trek anniversary and realized there was value in marketing that and recognizing it and having a big brouhaha clam bake kind of celebration. And they went, okay, finally it's time. Let's come up with a way to have another series. So all that happened in 86 and all of that comes out of the trilogy and all of that was Harv at the root.
With Star Trek 5, do you sense in talking to him or just knowing his involvement in it, any frustration or even bitterness? I hate to use the word bitterness, but any frustration on his part about the way that turned out? Because I just think about the fact that, you know, if 5 had been as successful as 2, 3, and 4, either box office or just fan reception, then he would have probably continued on and been involved in 6 as well. And who knows beyond that in terms of Star Trek?
Yeah, no, I didn't, you know, and again, we're sitting talking in 2011, so it's much later. If anything, he was a little bit bitter about the J.J., you know, the Bad Robot movie in 2009 being an Academy Young Kirk Spock set, even though it was an alternate universe. I wonder what the other side of the room voice sounds like in the alternate universe. But
that's a good question.
even though it was that, I think he felt a little miffed. And in fact, there was some, he made a public statement or two that was quoted in some of the trade papers. You can go back and find it, where he was saying, hey guys, you want to pay me something for my idea here? I wrote this Academy script that you've seen. And I think either he was given a little something or ignored or whatever it was, but nothing came of that. You know, you could make the case that, well, there could be a million young Academy, you know, young cadet Academy scripts for Kirk and Spock in the cast out there. But he, as far as being bitter about 5, no, I think after 3 movies, and from what he was telling me that day, I get the sense that he felt his gut told him this is going to be problematic. His team player sense of being in the Star Trek family said, oh, come back one more for the team. You know, you can, and talked himself into thinking, I can, whatever I'm thinking is going to be problematic here, I can make it right. And in the end, they couldn't. And, you know, the budget cuts and some of the battles they had, with things and weather and the location shooting and some of that right off the bat that put them behind a little bit. Some of that, you know, who knows if anybody could have helped that. But, I don't think that really, in fact, if nothing else, the fact that 5 was a little lackluster would almost make you think callous studio execs would say, okay, time to bring in some young kids. The old guy, the old geezers have had their day, you know? So it may have been we didn't get to that. And it may have been quoted somewhere else saying, it may have been a response to feeling that was the trend of things, that he went with that idea. Or it may have been just the purely creative idea. Because he has Kirk and Spock and McCoy talking as an envelope, or McCoy at least talking as an envelope framing device about, oh, yes, back when we were young, you know, at the Academy. And then that, that bridges it. So, no, I don't think it was anything about five. And I think somebody woke up and said, we can't throw out the old guys because it's the anniversary year. We need them around. You know, we have one more at least. Then they got crossways over that, I think.
Well, you know, this has come up over and over, even in recent years. But if you go back to when they were developing Enterprise and the ideas that were being thrown around, there was, of course, the Excelsior series. And there was also an Academy series idea at that time as well. I mean, does that grow out of Harv's original ideas for Star Trek VI in any way?
Well, I think, again, it's like when we pitched, it's like when Voyager started and Janet and I pitched the idea of they find Klingons the Delta Quadrant. Well, one of the cast members was a half Klingon. So it's kind of like, well, here's a duh idea. And I just, you know, an Academy, a young Academy throwback series format is just one of those duh ideas out there. So on one hand, I can see him being miffed that he didn't get any recognition for it when they went that way. But on the other hand, unless it was just like note for note, the same damn, the same damn story, the fact of it being a setting. I mean, obviously they're cadets. They have to find a crisis. They have to deal with that on their own. It wasn't quite as galaxy shaking, I think, as 09 turned out to be. But
I remember writing an article about the potential of an Academy series back when Enterprise was being developed.
Well,
of course, my article was titled, Can Star Trek Be Saved by the Bell?
Well, you know, the other old phrase that everybody always tosses around when they talk about an Academy series, it's come and gone with the times, but they used to talk about, you know, Starfleet 90210, you know, or something, with the youth, some of the youth shows that were on. And of course, then they'd be on for 7 or 8 years, and those young actors don't look so young by the time it's out there. But
that's right.
You know, things like the Captain Sulu Excelsior show, I think some of those things were more fan ideas or fan dreams than they were seriously considered. I mean, there was at least one focus group where Paramount people floated some ideas for discussion points with, I can't remember now if it was a dedicated fan audience or if it was just random people and they hoped there were, you know, half of them would be fans and they'd have some disinterested people thrown in there too to with the percentages as a sample. But, you know, they had the CSI or the Navy SEALs type Starfleet show. They had the Academy show. I don't know if even there if the Sulu Excelsior show was out there, and the, you know, founding of the Federation Romulan War type, you know, pre-Federation, we're heroic and stupid pioneers kind of show, which was always the one I wanted to do, but because I thought it'd be fascinating to do it, and I just didn't think they'd cut it off before they actually got to the founding of the Federation, the Romulan War. I just think that those were ideas that were easy options, and they were always banded about. And anytime anybody talked about a new format, those are the things that would come to the surface.
Yeah, well, it is kind of an obvious one there, so I wasn't surprised to see even, it used in the JJ film.
Even more obvious than Klingons in the Delta Quadrant. Yeah.
All right. Well, we've been talking about Harv Bennett for about an hour here. So just to wrap up, like we said at the top of the show, it's important for Star Trek fans to know how the franchise got to where it is now and what were the key moments and who were the key people there. And Harv Bennett is most definitely one of those people. I cannot imagine that Star Trek would exist without Harv Bennett. Without the Wrath of Khan in particular, as we've said a number of times today, I just can't imagine that we would have everything that we have now. So it was really a pivotal moment. But as you also said, as we age, people slip out of our view again. So what should people really remember, and how should we keep the memory of Harv Bennett alive in the future for fandom? Because Star Trek itself is obviously not going anywhere. It's going to be around 50 years, 100 years from now.
Right. Well, I think in Star Trek Online, they should go to Virtual Chicago, and right next to the statue of Dr. Bob Hartley, there should be a statue honoring Harv Bennett. No, I just
made that up on the spur of the moment.
Yeah,
they have the Leonard Nimoy Memorial.
That was very touching too. I was referring back to that there's the Spock. It's a Spock statue.
Sure, but in honor
in Vulcan, yeah. But somewhere they have, and they're going to put other ones up too, but a little plaque with basically Gene and the cast that have passed away so far, the main cast.
Okay.
I saw a picture, I saw a screen grab today. We do need to remember that without Harv, I mean, you know, Nick Meyer is the amazing person he brings in who pulls, you know, stop and think about it a minute. They were scrambling around to do even a small budget movie, and they had five different treatments that were, you know, in various stages of crappiness, you know, close to it to far away. And Nick, they sat down and went through the best of those and tossed out the worst and merged them all together. And I mean, Harv and Nick sat down and kind of did that together on the dead run. And then Nick went off and wrote the script and came back. Oh, great. And it's like gangbanging Yesterday's Enterprise, you know, later on. Only we're talking about a movie here, not a 1 hour episode. And yeah. Then, but finding Nick Meyer and early on deciding that, you know, to sequelize Khan, but that decision grew out of, hey, I'm going to sit down and watch the episodes because I know nothing really about Star Trek aside from it was a hit and the guy with the pointy ears was in it and, you know, and it was a failed 3-year show. That was the old, you know, meme of the original series. So a guy that was savvy enough to do that, seriously take on the reins, a successful producer, you know, like we say, he had
lots of shows with man in the title.
Right, right. Yes. Lots of shows with man in the title. So he didn't, you know, but he saw it as a step up if he could pull it off, I'm sure. Yeah. And his foot in the door of, you know, it's the old TV versus movie world thing. He would get his foot in the door of features if he could pull this off. And he did and brought a lot of people along with him and made sure, if not saved a franchise, made sure that it, you know, lived long and prospered.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks, Larry, for sharing your experience with Harv today. That was very interesting to hear. And, you know, he was such a personable guy, sat down so open with you, and great information to know there. We will, as we did with our Leonard Nimoy memorial, we will dispense with the usual ending of the show here. Mm-hmm. But I would like to tell everyone how to share their thoughts with us. If you go over to Facebook, we have a group there called the Babel Conference. You can type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. Or go to our website and click discussion on the menu bar. It's a closed group. It's just for our listeners. We only promote it here on the air. But we have great discussions there, hundreds and hundreds of members there. Larry's there as well.
I get sucked in occasionally, right?
Pretty often, yeah. And so you can come there and share your thoughts with us on Harv Bennett and just start a discussion or join in one that's already going on. You can tag us in the comments if you want so we know that you posted because it's kind of hard to keep up with everything that's going on there. So that's one way you can get in touch with us. You can also go to our website, trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the ready room and that'll come to me. And you can also send a voicemail, speakpipe.com/trekfm, if you'd like to share something by voice and maybe I can play it here on the show. And Larry, what if people want to find you and also keep up with other things you have going on? And especially the Khan of Wrath is going to be really important when that's done because, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, you've got a lot of Harv on camera talking about that.
Talking about that and maybe some bonus features when we get to the DVD Blu-ray stage. We'll include some of those tangent topics. Or if anyone out there is listening and is needing footage of Harv Bennett talking about some of these topics, I'm the guy you need to find. But the ConnorWrath.com is there. But of course, my central hub is LarryNemechek.com and my TreklandBlog.com, where I have yet to put my Leonard thoughts up. I've been talking to everybody else and writing for everything else except my own blog because it's been such an incredible week. And then here comes the need to talk about Harv and remember him and make sure everyone knows about his place and that his legacy is secure. And I'll be doing that too soon. But at Larry Nemechek on Twitter, my Larry Nemechek's Trekland is Facebook, and those are the main places. But Khan of Wrath is, we're trying to start narrowing that down. We're talking to Nichelle Nichols next week at the time we record this.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
So interesting timing with all this other going on, too. So, I'm just very, very appreciative of Harv, and in hindsight, really glad we got to him when we did. So there's of all the things in the world that get by you, I think I tweeted the other day about, you know, just jump in and do it if you need to do something and don't put it off the way this week has been going. And there's a
good
great
advice.
The things I did miss out doing with Leonard, but I'm so glad I had that experience with Harv and been a real pleasure to share it with people today. And there's still more there because I didn't even go back through the film or the transcript and hopefully a lot of other things to have fun with as the years go by with Harv.
Definitely. Well, listen to the rest of the network, everyone. I don't yet know what the other hosts have planned, but I'm pretty sure that there will be some coverage of Harv Bennett's work on some of the other shows, so you can catch those.
I know Mike and Max were already talking to me about maybe coming on and doing... They haven't covered Harv's work yet in their format, so...
Yeah.
That'll be coming down
the line. Yeah, I was figuring Commentary Trek Stars would probably do that. So you've got Mike and Max there, and of course John Mills also now on that show with them. Mm. So that's a great platform for talking about this. So keep your eyes open for other talk on the network. And if you'd like to catch me personally, I'm in the Babel Conference, as I mentioned, but you can also find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. And I have restarted my blog, finally. That's cbrianjones.com. I just did a fresh start on it because it's a long story, but I'm going to be writing new stuff now. So you can drop by, see that if you want. I did write a piece on there about Leonard Nimoy, which a lot of people have read.
Well, you're ahead of me, so.
All right, well...
Hey, Chris, I should mention, I didn't mention the other day, the family, this is back on Leonard, the family did put out 4 ideas for people if they wanted to give donations as memorials in Leonard's name. Okay. And I had that at Trekland. I think it's the next to last post, but one of the last 2 or 3 posts at my treklandblog.com is ideas for people to do gifts in Leonard's name. You know, the old in lieu of flowers thing with the funeral's long gone, but just as an FYI.
Okay, that's great. So everyone go check that out too if you want to find a way to contribute in Leonard's name. And I always like when they do that in lieu of flowers personally, because you can do something meaningful for others that way as well. All right. Well, Larry, I'm glad we were able to get together again. I mean, we've got to stop doing this. It's like late at night and we're like, we need to do a memorial show. Can maybe tomorrow we can grab an hour?
I know. So, I said this week, I'm planning ahead. I'm ready for hashtag RIP week to be over.
To be over. Yeah. That's right. All right. Well, I'm glad you had time today and I had time today to record this. And everyone, thanks for listening. And hopefully this will be the last memorial show that we do for quite a while. So tune into the other regular Ready Rooms as well, and everything else on the network. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you.